So it is July 7th, 2014 at Bhaktivedanta Manor in London, and we're going to be doing a four-day program on the Upadeshamrita of Rupa Goswami, which Prabhupada translated as a nectar of instruction. So tonight, do we have a chair for Kalamba now? Is she coming, or is she just peeking her head in and going out?
She's coming.
If she's coming, we need a chair for her. We need a chair for her over here. Yeah. So today we're going to be doing text 1 through 3. You all have your little outlines here, summaries. Kalangana, you should sit over here. You sit over here so you can hear me, because I don't have a mic. Yeah, right here, so she can also see me. Yeah, there you go. Excellent. Okay. How many of you have a copy of the Nectar of Instruction with you? How many people have a copy? Three only? Do any of you know the verses? No? All blank faces? Well, if you can kind of share a little bit, whoever does have a book, looks like we have four books, so you can share, we can recite the verses together. So if you look at your outline here, maybe you could pass one of those outlines to me and I'll give it to somebody if they come, but otherwise, it's nice if I can have one also, just one. I don't need all of them, just one. Okay, so you'll see that we've divided the Nectar of Instruction up into four categories. So the first category is looking at ourselves and our life. The second category is looking at devotees and society. The next one, absorption in Krishna. And the last one, better and best. Now, what's interesting about the Nectar of Instruction as a whole is that it's describing the progress of bhakti from beginning to end in 11 verses. So sometimes we describe bhakti, in fact, Rupa Goswami describes bhakti as the progression of Shraddha to Prem. How many of you are familiar with the Shraddha to Prem progression? So that's a list of stages. From faith to association with devotees, to the practice of bhakti, the removal of anartas, steadiness, taste, attraction, ecstasy, and love. And we often describe the process of bhakti in that framework. Sometimes we describe the process of bhakti in terms of what we call kanista, majjhima, and uttama. How many of you have heard kanista, majjhima, and uttama? Right, so that really means, kanista just means unsteady, majjhima just means middle, and uttama just means top. So it's really like saying beginning, intermediate, and advanced. And there's at least three different systems of beginning, intermediate, and advanced. And then there's other ways of describing the process of bhakti. We can talk about offensive chanting, clearing stage, and then pure chanting. We can talk about degrees of faith. We can talk about performing bhakti in the modes, and then transcendentally. And all of these are describing the process of bhakti, but from a little different perspective, just like if you were looking at the way a child becomes an adult, and you can talk about the child growing up physically, you can talk about the child growing up socially, intellectually, in so many different areas, and they don't all coincide. So it's not that physical development and intellectual development progress at exactly the same rate. A person could be at one stage in intellectual development and another stage in physical development. So these different explanations of the process of bhakti are looking at the process from different perspectives. And this Nectar of Instruction is one such description of how you go from the beginning to the end. And what I find particularly fascinating about this description is that it really, really starts at the beginning and it really, really ends at the end. So some of the descriptions of the progress of bhakti aren't exactly like that. Some of them start kind of in the middle. For For example, Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha is also a description of the process of bhakti. It goes all the way to the very top, but it starts at the middle. It starts with people who already have a guru and are already chanting the Gayatri Mantra. Because the very first thing it says is have love for your guru. Well, you don't have a guru, then how are you going to do the first word of the first verse? You're kind of stuck. So there are systems that start in the middle. And this one really starts at the beginning. So the very beginning here is control yourself. Get yourself together. Then once you get yourself together, you can be in a society of devotees. Once you're in a society of devotees, what you do, you get attraction for Krishna. And when you get attraction for Krishna, what are the different levels of destinations? And what's nice about these first three verses for working on ourselves first is that Srila Prabhupada said the high... Can you not hear me? You want me to stick closer? Would that help? Okay, you're leaning over towards me.
No, it's perfect.
Okay. So Srila Prabhupada said the highest principle... Okay. The highest principle is to save others, and higher than that is to save yourself. Sometimes we see people who are so busy at saving others and so busy at working at Vaishnava qualities and relationships with other devotees and so busy at trying to love Krishna that they forget all about saving themselves. And just like in the airplane, you have to put your oxygen mask on first before you can help somebody else. So these first three verses are about saving ourselves, getting ourselves properly situated. And no matter how high up you go, you have to always kind of cycle back to these verses and make sure that you are saved, that you're on the safe platform. There is a wonderful book by Bhaktivinoda Thakur called Bhaktya Loka. It's by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. It's called Bhaktya Loka. If you have a copy of the electronic Vedabase, the folio where you can search through all of Srila Prabhupada's books, if you have one of the later editions of that, it is available for free. You can find it online and download it. It's one of the handiest, most wonderful tools you can find, especially for research and study in Prabhupada's books, even if you're not going to read all of Prabhupada's books on the Vedabase. But there's a copy of Bhakti Loka there. So if you go to the section, Writings of Past Acharyas, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you can find an electronic copy of Bhakti Loka there. And, of course, Bhakti Loka is also available as a printed book. I'm sure it's available from Bhaktivedanta Library Services. In Bhakti Loka, Bhaktivinoda Thakur takes texts 2 and 3, which we're going to be doing today, and he analyzes each point in depth, and he analyzes each point both from the perspective of a renunciate and the perspective of a householder, which is, I find, extremely helpful. He's saying that these are going to be applied a little differently depending on whether you're married or you're renounced. And I would really suggest, because there is not any way we're going to have time in the time that we have to get into that kind of depth, that you get yourself a copy of that book. As I say, it's available for free electronically, and that you study texts 2 and 3 of this book along with Bhaktivinoda Thakur's extensive, wonderful, wonderful explanations. There are certain sections of that book that I just read over and over and over and over and over again, and have found to be extremely helpful. Okay, so we're going to do tonight texts 1, 2, and 3. And if you have a book, you can share. Maybe we can have three people sharing a book, if that's possible. And then we can just please sing the Sanskrit and say the English of texts 1, 2, and 3 together. Okay, text 1, everybody together, please. Vacho vegam manasa krodha vegam jiva vegam udara pasta vegam etan veganyo visheta dhira sarvam apimam prithivim sashishyat. Okay, translation we can say together. A sober person who can tolerate the urge to speak, the mind's demands, the actions of anger, and the urges of the tongue, belly, and genitals is qualified to make disciples all over the world. Okay, let's go to text 2. Everybody ready? Text 2. Let's say the Sanskrit together.
Achyahara prayasascha prajaponiyamagraha jana sangastaloyamcha sadbir bhakti vinashyati. One's devotional service is spoiled when he becomes too entangled in the following six activities, 1. Eating more than necessary or collecting more funds than required. 2. Over-endeavoring for mundane things that are very difficult to obtain. 3. Talking unnecessarily about mundane subject matters. 4. Practicing the scriptural rules and regulations only for the sake of following them and not for the sake of spiritual advancement, or rejecting the rules and regulations of the scriptures and working independently or whimsically. 5. Associating with worldly-minded persons who are not interested in Krishna consciousness. And 6. Being greedy for mundane achievements. And text 3. Utsaha nishchayat daryat tatat karma pravartanat sangatyaga sato vritte sadbir bhakti prasiddhati. There are 6 principles favorable to the execution of pure devotional service. 1. Being enthusiastic. 2. Endeavoring with confidence. 3. Being patient. 4. Acting according to regulative principles such as Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, hearing, chanting, and remembering Krishna. 5. Abandoning the association of non-devotees. And 6. Following in the footsteps of the previous acharyas. These 6 principles undoubtedly assure the complete success of pure devotional service.
So the first verse talks about controlling the senses and controlling the mind. If we don't have our mind and senses under control, at least to a reasonable extent, then we can't really even say that we're human. We're acting like an animal. Now, of course, here it's talking about the ultimate control, pritivimsasashat, that such person who has the ultimate control can make disciples all over the world. This is, many times people ask, you know, what is a guru? Who is a guru? So here, Rupa Goswami is giving a very succinct description of who's qualified to be guru, someone who can control their senses and their mind. So what is he listing? You tell me the things he's listing. We have it on your paper. Right. Speaking, the mind, anger, genitals, tongue, and the belly. So those are all the things that need to be controlled. And it's very fascinating that Rupa Goswami is not advocating. You guys have a summary book there for people who came? Rupa Goswami is not advocating some kind of repression. That's not his interest. And anyway, that wouldn't be very possible. Have we tried to control our senses and mind and anger, etc., through repression? I'm sure everybody's tried to do that. You haven't tried to just repress your anger? Or suppress your anger? And what happens? You blow up eventually. It doesn't work. I know of one family that ended up getting divorced. The woman sort of exploded one day. And the husband came to me and he said, I don't know what happened. He said, we never had an argument for 10 years and all of a sudden she's exploding. It was really terrible. You know, she just kept all this stuff inside for 10 years and never expressed it. And when she finally expressed it, it was too late to do anything about it. It built up to the point that it couldn't be solved anymore. So we find that just repression doesn't work. If people try to repress their senses, try to repress their mind, try just, okay, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that. That people get frustrated, they get more angry, or they end up doing the very thing they don't want to do. Right? I know of a number of devotees who, before they were devotees, were on some sort of very strict diet. And inevitably, they say things like, you know, I would follow it 5 days and then I would pig out on the weekends. I have some friends who are raw food vegans, usually. Usually, not always. So this is the tendency, yes? The general tendency. This, of course, in Sanskrit is called bhogatyaga. We enjoy and then we renounce, we enjoy and then we renounce, we enjoy and then we renounce. In fact, without renouncing, you can't enjoy. You can't just eat pizza all day and enjoy it, can you? If you ate pizza all day, every day, would you still enjoy it? No, you wouldn't. So you have to renounce things in order to enjoy them materially. And the renunciation stage of the bhogatyaga is not real renunciation. It's just part of the enjoyment cycle. That's all. It's simply required for enjoyment that there's some renunciation. So that kind of renunciation that's just part of the enjoyment process in the material world, or renunciation that comes out of disgust, or renunciation that comes out of repression. Now, out of disgust, you're actually still very attached. Mm-hmm. If you're just, I hate sense gratification. What you want to do is be flat, emotionally flat, towards material things, not hating them. Hatred is just as much of a attachment as love. And people take birth again with certain other people because they hate them, just as much as taking birth with them because they love them. You all know that? If you die on the battlefield killing your enemy, you can easily take birth again as brother and sister, or you can become husband and wife, or parent and child, or whatever, because you're absorbed in that person. This is why that demons who are absorbed in wanting to kill Krishna get liberated, because they're still absorbed in Krishna. And that's why if you're absorbed in somebody or something with hatred, that's another kind of attachment. It's just a negative side of attachment. So that doesn't cure the problem. Repression just pushes things down and then it explodes. The renunciation that's just part of the enjoyment cycle isn't meaningful. It just doesn't mean anything. If you just have a huge meal and you say, I renounce eating for the next 6 hours, it just doesn't mean anything. It's not any kind of renunciation. And disgust is not renunciation either. It's not control. It's just the flip side of attachment. It's just another kind of attachment. It's a strong negative attachment. So Rupa Goswami is not talking about any of that. All right, well, what is he talking about? Maybe he's talking about just making all of these flat. Okay, I'm not going to talk about anything. I'm just going to be silent. Or I'm not going to think anything. I mean, I heard a devotee say this just a few weeks ago. When you're chanting japa, you should just make your mind blank. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. So, you know, you could think like that. We'll say nothing, we'll think nothing, we'll have no anger, we won't eat anything. No sex, what else here? So just nothing. And of course, there are yogis and there are yogic processes that are like that. They really are like that. You go away from the people in general. You have no sex. You have no speech. You empty your mind. You don't even eat. So how is that possible? Well, all the food we're eating is a transformation of sunlight. Yes? Isn't that a fact? Don't plants transform by photosynthesis? We all learned that in school, right? So the plants by photosynthesis, they're transforming sunlight into food. Really, all the food we're eating, if you're drinking milk even, the cow has eaten the grass and transformed that into milk. Ultimately, it's a transformation of sunlight with some water and some minerals from the earth. That's really all the food we're eating is a transformation of sunlight, water, and a very small amount of earth minerals. As I'm sure you know, you can grow plants hydroponically without soil. You just have to put in some nutrients. So there are yogis who can get their nourishment directly. They can pull their nourishment directly from the sunlight, directly from the water vapor in the air, and so forth, and they don't have a need to eat food. So it is certainly possible. There are certain kinds of yoga one can do where one is literally not doing any of these things. That is possible. But that, we know, is not at all what Rupa Goswami is suggesting, and we know that from the following verses where he talks about a society of devotees with loving exchanges. You can't exchange confidences with devotees if you're always silent, and you can't exchange food with devotees if you're not eating. So he's obviously not talking about making all the senses zero. And of course, Krishna himself does not advise this kind of yoga where you make everything nothing. He says that this kind of process is much slower. It's a bona fide process. It works. However, very few people are qualified to do it. It's something like, you know, if you want to get from here to France, you can fly a plane. But how many people are qualified pilots? You know, you can pay somebody else to fly a plane. But if you had to go by yourself, how many people are qualified pilots? Not very many. So even though you can say that that's a bona fide method, that's a good method to get from here to France, you have to either be able to fly a plane or have enough money to pay somebody else to fly a plane for you. Otherwise, you just can't avail yourself of that method. It won't work. If you say, well, you know, it's bona fide, but I get in the plane and I don't know how to fly, then I just crash into the English Channel. I don't get anywhere. Right? And somebody who's driving gets there before me because I'm in the hospital trying to recover from my crash. So most of us are not qualified to perform this kind of yoga. We just simply don't have the qualifications. And in any case, it's much more difficult and slow than the process of bhakti. It's much more difficult and much more slow than the process of bhakti because it involves first making everything empty materially and then filling yourself with Krishna. And the process of making yourself empty is not very pleasant. None of us want to be empty. That doesn't sound very nice. Okay, everybody, how would you like to have an empty life? Me, you know, who wants an empty life? And so it's not very attractive. It's not very pleasurable. It's sort of, we could say, if you had friends that were bad for you, and if we said, well, what you should do is first get rid of all your bad friends, have no friends, and then find some good friends. That would work. But it would also equally work to just say, start finding some good friends. And start substituting good friends for bad friends. That make sense? Just like often people will look for a new job while they're still working at an old job, if they can, unless they get fired. That's a much better way to do it than to say, okay, first I'll get fired, I have no job, I'm unemployed. So would you do that intentionally? Would you say, okay, I'm going to quit my job and have no job and have no income, and then I'll look for a new job? Most people don't do that. If they want to look for a new job, they keep their current job at the same time. I know my husband wanted to start a business for many, many years, and it kept failing. And then one Tamil president said to him, why don't you start a business while you have a job? Start it on the side, like a hobby. And once the business gets really going, then you can quit your job. It was wonderful advice. If you're going to move to a new house, you don't generally move out of your old house, just put all your possessions on the sidewalk, and then start looking for a new house. You generally look for a new house while you're still in your own house, if you have a choice about it. You know, if you have a choice about it. So bhakti is very much like that. Bhakti is very much like that. It doesn't consist of becoming empty first. It doesn't say, first get rid of all the old stuff, first get rid of all the bad stuff, and then get Krishna. Or get rid of all the bad stuff and just stay empty, and that your goal is to be empty, like the Buddhists say. That's your ultimate goal is emptiness. But in bhakti, it's filling it up with the good stuff. So when Rupa Goswami is saying that one should control these things, he's saying that one should control these things by doing them in a way that is spiritual, by doing them in a way that is helpful, by doing them in a way that will make you feel genuinely satisfied. So let's go through these. The first one is about speaking. And Srila Prabhupada talks about both speaking and writing in his purport. And he says that we all generally speak whenever we get an opportunity. And frankly, most of our speaking is not very beneficial. And it's not about anything substantial. Most of what we talk about, most of what we communicate with each other, it's about very petty things in our life or very petty things in other people's life. It's complaining, it's criticizing, it's most, or it's just about things of the world that have very little value. Who's winning the sports game, you know, what celebrity married whom or something. What celebrity had what plastic surgery, or you know, whatever it is that people talk about and write about. What natural catastrophe is happening in what country, and what criminal did what, you know, terrible activity, and what government is collapsing, and so forth and so on. All of which is just these very temporary. I mean, we have to know something of what's going on in the world. We shouldn't be known as fools. We shouldn't think World War I is still going on. I mean, we should have some. We should know something about what's going on in the world. But this shouldn't be our general speaking. So in terms of speaking, we're going to think about the five austerities of speech that Krishna gives in the Bhagavad Gita in the mode of goodness. Does anybody know what those are? The five austerities of speech in the mode of goodness in the Bhagavad Gita. Yeah?
Only something like beneficial?
Beneficial, yes.
Not harming, yeah.
Well, beneficial, not harming, so.
Truthful,
okay. Pleasing. Pleasing means the message itself is pleasing, the content is pleasing. Then not agitating to others, which is maybe what you meant by not harmful. That would mean the words themselves are not agitating. And then speaking from the Vedas. Regularly reciting the Vedas. So, of all of these, which do you think is the most important? Well, we often think that it's truthful. You know, we often think it's truthful. But sometimes the truth can be harmful. Well, if you recite, Prahlad Nandaswami said, well, if you recite the Vedas, you'll naturally do everything else. But then it's also which part of the Vedas are you reciting to which person in which circumstance? Because the right thing done at the wrong time or to the wrong person is the wrong thing. And it's interesting, we had a talk about this in Soho recently, that a lot of what differentiates the mode of goodness from the modes of passion and ignorance is the right time and place. The right thing at the wrong time and place is the wrong thing. If you go visit your friend at 1:30 in the morning, if you had a friend who said, anytime you're in my neighborhood, come by and see me. I did this to my sister. I actually did that to my sister when I was a teenager. She had always said, anytime you're by my place, you can come by and see me. And my friends and I were in New York City late at night. It was about 1 in the morning. I said, we're right by my sister's place. Let's go and see her. And she was not happy. Why are you waking me up at 1:30 in the morning? Is there an emergency? No, I just wanted to say hello. You said I could come by any time. No, she wasn't happy at all. So, you know, the right time and the right place is there. And even though the Vedas are perfect, the majority of the Vedas are in context. There's a context of what's applicable to what. You know, if somebody came to you and they want to know, how do I have a good marriage? You're not going to read to them the universal form from the Bhagavad Gita. This is how to have a good marriage. You know, it wouldn't make any sense. That wouldn't be a part that was applicable to them and what they're asking about and what their situation is. So certainly reciting the Vedas, but that's, again, time and place. And truthful is also time and place. Just like we have an offense on chanting, which is what? What offense on chanting is relevant to this question of speaking?
Demigods?
Could be. But particularly about speaking to others.
Asking
Well, yeah. That's true. I hadn't thought of that. That's certainly true. That's certainly true. Yeah, why don't we talk about that for a minute? Thank you. So that's certainly not beneficial, huh? If you're blaspheming devotees. Especially blasphemy means you're saying lies. Fault finding means you just find the faults in an ocean of good qualities. Right? Criticism is you're talking about a genuine fault, but blaspheming, you're making up something that's not even there. Bearing false witness, you're speaking lies. So that's very harmful for yourself and for others. Okay, what other ones of the offenses on chanting deal with? Speech.
The unfaithful, not to preach the glories.
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of, although I'm really happy you mentioned that one. So not to preach the glories of the holy name to those who are faithless. So that's a real, it's really talking about time and place and person, isn't it? Because everyone's supposed to preach the glories of the holy name. That's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to preach the glories of the holy name. Oops! Not to that person. Not now. So you have something great, but don't, like we say, don't throw your pearls before swine. Jesus said, if you throw your pearls in front of pigs, they'll just trample it into the dust. They'll disregard it. So, therefore, can we try to get this water? So, therefore, the main criteria of speaking is, am I benefiting others? Am I benefiting others? Is what I'm speaking, is it benefiting myself? And is it benefiting others? And, of course, false things are not going to benefit others, generally. Generally, what's beneficial is the truth. Sometimes it's actually beneficial not to be so truthful. You know, the husband should say to his wife, "I think you're the most beautiful woman in the world," even if he doesn't really think that. And even if the woman's wondering, "I wonder if he really thinks that." "I know I'm not the most beautiful woman in the world, but maybe he does think that." So that's good for the relationship, even if it's not exactly truthful. Do you follow? The woman says to her husband, "You're the most clever husband in the world. You're my hero. You're the best husband in the world." Again, she doesn't really believe that he's the best husband in the world. She didn't have some sort of a logical analysis of every single husband in the world and decide that this man was the best. But again, you know, so that's not a literally truthful statement. But it's certainly beneficial. It's certainly something that's beneficial. But so the main thing here in speaking is to be beneficial. And the highest benefit, of course, for anybody is what will bring the speaker and the hearer closer to Krishna.
Does that link with pleasing as well?
It's interesting that you bring that up, because pleasing in that context means that the message itself is very pleasing. And sometimes what's going to be most beneficial for people is a message that's not so pleasing. I mean, there are times when one has to give a message that's not so pleasing. But we have to say, you know, you're a conditioned soul, and that means you're full of lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion. And that's not a very pleasant thing to say to people. But as far as possible, the message itself should also be pleasing. As far as possible, thank you. Particularly the parents, the guru, the teacher must sometimes give messages that are not pleasing. You can't always say to your students, "You passed the test," because maybe they didn't. And sometimes you have to give a message that's not pleasing. Sometimes you have to say, "I'm really sorry, but this is something you need to work on." But you can only give a not pleasing message to people who are receptive. You have to have a very particular kind of relationship with people to give a not pleasing message and have it be beneficial. Because if you give a not pleasing message to people who aren't open to it, it will again be harmful. Does that make sense? Because we've extremely, extremely careful about that. And then not agitating to others means the language. Modern society, people are very fond of speaking in very harsh language. As many swear words as they can put in one sentence, they'll do that, you know, isn't it? They're proud of their harsh language. But austerity of speech is also speaking in sweet language. So the greatest benefit that one can give anyone is to help them develop in love for Krishna. Now, this doesn't mean that the greatest benefit you can give anybody, again, is pounding them over the head with the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. I was just in Soho, and one devotee was talking about how another devotee was struggling with chanting his rounds, and he stopped coming to the temple because every time he came to the temple, the only thing the other devotees would say to him is, "Are you chanting your rounds?" And so he didn't want to come anymore because they only made him feel guilty. I said, you know, better to ask him to do something he likes. If he's struggling with chanting his rounds right now, ask him to do something else. Ask him to be in a kirtan, ask him to help out in the, you know, with the serving the prasadam or something that he enjoys, instead of just harassing him. So sometimes we can justify harming people in the name of helping people. Right? We can do things that are discouraging, that are demeaning, that are shaming, that embarrass people, all in the name of, well, I'm helping them advance in Krishna consciousness. So Krishna consciousness means that one is feeling inner peace and inner love for Krishna and inner satisfaction. So our speech should be such that we bring that to people. And this is very difficult to do. It's not an easy thing to do. Which is why Rupa Goswami says if someone does all this, they're qualified to make disciples all over the world. It's not a small thing. But it's something we should be extremely conscious of. One of the most genuinely advanced devotees that I know has made the point to me many times that it's really what goes in and what comes out of our mouth that makes all the difference. We say so many times, Atashri Krishna Namadi Nabhaved Graham Indriya Sevan mukehi jiwado swayam eva sparap yaha. That the main way we can understand God is with our tongue. And tongue means eat what we eat and what we speak. So what goes in, what comes out. And our tendency when speaking is to be selfish, to be frivolous and foolish, time-wasting, self-centered, or harming others, you know, often in the name of Krishna consciousness. So about Krishna in ways that will really elevate people, in ways that will really fill people with love. Okay, and then the mind. So Srila Prabhupada talks about here. It's a little awkward for me without a physical book. Okay, he talks about the agitations of the flickering mind. He says they're divided into two things. Avivirodha priti, or unrestricted attachment, and the other is called virodha yukta krodha, anger arising from frustration. So this is the problem with the mind. We talked about the problem with speech. It tends to be frivolous, self-centered, or harmful. And the problems with the mind is it tends to be attachment and anger. Someone was just asking me about this last night. How do we avoid anger? And our anger, it comes from our attachment. It comes from my feeling of lack, that I think, I don't have what I need, I'm going to get it from you, and if you don't give it to me, I become angry. So this is the problem with the mind. The mind is thinking, I need, I want, and then when I don't get, or I don't like the way that I get, or I don't like the time that I get, or whatever, I become angry. And this anger is a mechanism that we use to try to force getting what we think that we need. That's basically what anger is. It's a kind of war. Another country has what your country thinks you need or you want, and they're not going to give it to you by trade or by negotiation, so you start killing them to get it. So it's very much like that. I think I need something, I want something. I'm not getting it, or I'm not getting it how I want, or when I want, or whatever. It's not satisfying me. And then I become angry to try to force. So what the mind needs to do is to become satisfied. And this, again, is very, very, very difficult. Krishna talks about in the 12th chapter being silent and satisfied with anything. And this is also one of the austerities of the mind, is to always be satisfied. Again, this is extremely, extremely difficult for a conditioned soul. Because the tendency is for the mind always to be unsatisfied. Whatever you get, you want something more. This is very much the nature of the mode of passion. More, bigger, better, more, bigger, better, more, bigger, better. You know, always want to have things better and better and better. And the person who's really satisfied is a rare person indeed. It's something that's very rare and very, very valuable. So how are we going to do that? How are we going to have a peaceful mind? And the only way you can have a peaceful mind is to fill it with Krishna, because Krishna has everything we need. And when our mind is full with Krishna, then we do feel satisfied. In fact, someone whose mind is really full with Krishna doesn't want anything in the world. And a person whose mind is full with Krishna can be so detached that they don't even care if they get proper clothes or house or food or anything. We have so many examples of persons like this, that they're feeling so inwardly satisfied spiritually that nothing external matters to them at all. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that if you fill your mind with Krishna, you'll run away from home and live in the street. But it does mean that things won't bother you anymore. This is freedom, where your happiness is not dependent on what's going on externally and what facility you have or not, and whether people are nice to you or not nice to you, and whether they remember your birthday or they don't remember your birthday, or whatever it is that we're attached to, that it just won't matter anymore. So this thinking of Krishna very literally means thinking about Krishna. It means thinking about Krishna's form and Krishna's qualities and Krishna's pastimes and being absorbed in the spiritual world. And then it also means very much thinking of how to serve Krishna and how to please him, how to work for his mission, instead of making plans for our own happiness in the world, which never quite work out. exactly the way we want them, do they? No, they don't.
Funny thing about that. So instead of making those kind of, I mean, we have to make obviously some plans.
I have to go to the shop and, okay, what time am I going to go? And I mean, but instead of having our mentality focused on those kind of plans, we have our mentality focused on how am I going to preach? How am I going to spread Krishna consciousness? What can I do for the Sankirtan's movement? And we talked about anger in relationship to the mind, that part of controlling the mind ends up controlling anger, because when you're self-satisfied by connection with Krishna, you're not going to get so angry. But Prabhupada talks about how anger has its original spiritual form, which is really fascinating, because we definitely think of anger particularly as being very evil. It is. Material anger is really, really nasty thing. But there is a kind of loving anger that's very sweet. And this kind of loving anger doesn't make you lose control of your senses. You're really then using your temper instead of losing it. And to never experience any anger is not possible for a soul. These emotions are part of the soul. And therefore, we can certainly have anger at the people who are, or the philosophies that are damaging the world. We can have anger at the people who are mistreating the animals. We can have anger at the miseducation that's going on in the world. And this anger can also, just like Arjuna's anger incited him to fight the battle, so our anger can also be part of our impetus, at least some of the time, for going out and preaching. Not that we should be angry at the people we're preaching to, but a loving anger that here are these wonderful people, they're part and parcel of Krishna, and they're being misled. Then the genitals, Prabhupada says here that there's two urges of the genitals. One is legitimate and one is not legitimate. So the legitimate urge is to have a husband, wife, and to produce nice children. This is, of course, the natural tendency. In modern society, we don't think of that as being natural anymore. We've had so many years now of contraception and abortion in society that it's very hard for many people to think about sex in its natural context. It's just like we have so many zero-calorie foods. So people have become used to the concept of eating as separated from nutrition and health of the body. So in a similar way, people have started to separate sex from its obviously natural function. So to use the genitals to produce nice children in a loving marriage, that is proper control of the genitals. And Prabhupada says about how we need many, many hundreds of wonderful children. We need to make facility for the living entities who are qualified to take birth as human beings and qualified to take up devotional service to receive a suitable human body. Having nice children is something like, it's something like having an ashram building. Like here at the temple, we have an ashram building for the men, we have an ashram building for the ladies. Why? So that if somebody wants to live at the temple and take up Krishna consciousness as their full-time occupation, that they have a place to stay. If someone said, okay, I want to, we were talking about this Kalangana, right? Remember? We were talking about the value of the ladies' ashram, and you were talking about how we're living here at Vaikuntha. And if somebody wants to do full-time service for the deities, and they want to do full-time service in the kitchen, and we said, well, we're not going to give you a place to stay, you just have to sleep on the grass, well, that wouldn't be very good. So in the same way, when a soul is ready for a human body and wants to take part in Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement by having a child, what you're doing is you're giving them a body to function in on this planet. You're giving them a vehicle. You're giving them a room, basically. These bodies are like a walking room. And you're giving them a human body, so you're giving them that facility. So it's a very great service. It's a very important service. And it's just as important and just as difficult as running a woman's ashram. Being a mother, being a father. So that kind of use of the genitals is very wonderful. And of course, using it just, well, I'm just going to use my genitals for my own pleasure and separate from Krishna. I'm not going to use it to produce nice children. Then that's going to separate us from Krishna. Then the tongue and the belly, here we're looking at the tongue, not in terms of our speaking, but in terms of our eating. And of course, eating is one of the main pleasures of the conditioned soul. And Prabhupada talks extensively here about being very careful that we're not eating prasadam just for its taste, that we're eating prasadam as a form of worship. We're eating prasadam as a way to advance in bhakti. And he talks about controlling the belly in terms of doing occasional fasting. Fasting on Ekadasi, at least from grains and beans, fasting on Janmashtami, and in that way the belly is controlled. Okay, so now we become a basic civilized human being if we're controlling these things, at least on a general level. If we're completely using them for Krishna, then we're at the platform of being guru. But if we're even endeavoring to use them for Krishna, and we're working in that direction, then we can really start then moving into the next place, which is what are the good things I can do for bhakti and what are the bad things I can do for bhakti. If you don't have your senses under control, you can't even talk about what's favorable and what's unfavorable for bhakti, because you won't be able to do them. So let's look at this, at these lists. Eating more than necessary, collecting more money than required, working too hard for mundane things that are difficult to obtain, talking too much about mundane things unnecessarily, having too many rules, having rules for the sake of rules, or not having enough rules, having the wrong kind of friends, and again, too many material achievements. So we have a lot of here, too much, too much, too much, too much. More than what you need, more than what you need. My daughter had one friend many years ago who never threw out anything she got in the mail. Ever. 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 And she would teach dance in her house, so there was one room that was clear, and the rest of the room was piles of papers and magazines and advertisements, you know, such that there was just a little path to walk. Too much. Too much. And you really think about the family members of those people when those people die. What is it going to be? How many months is it going to take them to clean out their houses? I was once helping one friend. I was staying at their house, and I was helping them clean off their desk. And I said, you have a lot of mail on your desk that's from 2 years ago that's never been opened. You know, so we tend to do this. Too much, too much, too much, too much, too much. And I think especially in the modern West, we tend to do too much. Prabhupada talks a lot in this purport about how there's enough for everybody on the planet if everyone just took what they needed. That the problems with scarcity are because people are taking more than what they need. And again, this is especially a problem for us in the developed Western countries. That most of us have far, far, far more than what we need. I mean, just way over what we need. I visited one householder's home once I was staying there, and every single horizontal surface other than the floor was covered with stuff. Every surface. I was stayed there overnight, and I travel with deities, and I didn't have any place to put my deities because there was just literally no place. Anything other than the floor that was a flat surface had stuff on it. And it had stuff piled upon stuff piled upon stuff. And a lot of the stuff they had was boxes of things that they bought in bulk. Like a huge box of shampoo, you know, a huge box of toothpaste, a huge box. And it was a big house, too. It was a really big house. It had a whole downstairs cellar that was three floors. And I thought, my goodness, these people are buying enough supplies for their great-great-grandchildren. You know, there's no way that in their life they're going to use all of this stuff. You know, you get it on sale, right, when you buy in bulk? They could have started their own shop. And at one point I said, you guys really have a lot of stuff. And the husband said, well, we're householders, you know. Okay. And so too much. It's interesting in the Nectar Devotion that Prabhupada talks about over-endeavor as far as too many vows in bhakti. He says, like making a vow you can't keep. You know, if somebody says, well, I'm going to read Prabhupada's books 2 hours a day and chant 40 rounds a day, and they can't even do it for one day. I'm going to start getting up at 1 in the morning, you know, and they can't even do it for more than a day or two. So that's another kind of too much. Too much, too much, too much. So what? Also too much knowledge. Knowledge, collecting knowledge just for the sake of collecting knowledge. You know, these people who get 3 PhDs and 1 MD, and they're just, they don't do anything. They're just collecting, collecting, collecting. I know one devotee like that who's always studying and never doing anything with what he studies. And I've said to him, okay, you've studied enough. You're 45 years old. You've just studied, 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 studied. Okay, do something now. So just simply collecting knowledge to collect knowledge, collecting honors, collecting followers, collecting food. So although all that kind of too much will affect your bhakti. Too much about mundane things. Okay, you need to know who the prime minister is. You need to know if we're at war. You know, there's some mundane things you need to know. I'm going to be traveling on Friday, and I noticed that the security measures have increased, and you have to be at the airport even earlier now because you're going to do more security measures, and they're going to ask you to turn on your cell phone, and if you can't turn it on, they won't let you board the plane, which means you have to have all of your batteries charged on all your devices, because if your battery's worn out and you can't turn it on, they won't let you on the plane. So I have to know that because I'm going to get on the plane. You follow? So that's it's a mundane thing. But we may have to know about something like that, but not too much. Not, you know, the people who talk all day about sports and all day about celebrities and all day about anything other than Krishna. So again, too much, too much. And wrong kind. Wrong kind of friends, wrong kind of talking, wrong kind of things. Too much of any of these things, or the wrong kind of things. And it can even be too much of rules. I was recently at one temple where someone who was rather new to Krishna consciousness said, it seems to me that this bhakti yoga is full of lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of rules, and there's always new ones I'm learning about. So, too many rules too. Thinking that bhakti is all about rules. And that if I just follow all the rules perfectly, then I'll become enlightened. As if it was some kind of a mechanical process. So following the rules for the sake of the rules and collecting rules and inventing rules. Or not following the rules at all. Saying, well, we don't need any rules. We'll just have love. Forget about rules. What's interesting is in this section of Bhakti Loka, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that on the highest platform, you don't need any rules except for love. He says in the spiritual world, the only rules there is have love and don't have envy. That's it. You don't need any other rules. He also says the kind of rules you have to follow depend on how advanced you are and what position you're in. And that the kind of rules you follow change as you advance. Isn't that interesting? Makes sense though, doesn't it? Just like the kind of rules you follow change when you go from being a child to being an adult. You don't have to follow the same rules. I remember one of my students asked me many years ago, why don't you have to raise your hand before you talk? And I said, well, who would call on me? Who would recognize me? Who would give me permission to speak? So it's not the same. The rules for the teacher are not the same as the rules for the student. The rules for the parents, the rules for the teenagers are not the same as the rules for the children. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that if we remain attached to lower rules when we come to a higher level, those lower rules will act like chains around our feet and keep us from advancing. So many times in the Hare Krishna movement we say, don't go too fast, be careful, don't go too fast. But also, be careful, don't go too slowly. When you're ready to take the next step, you should take the next step. If you take the next step prematurely, you'll fall. And if you don't take the next step when you're meant to, then it'll be like chains around your feet and difficulty. So again, too many rules or the wrong kind of rules, following the rules for somebody else. Yes?
How do you know when to take the next step?
How do you know when to take the next step? Very good question. Well, one way you know to take the next step is you're really not happy. That's a good sign. Of course, usually that means you've put it off too long, that you were supposed to have taken the step quite a while ago. Well, you see some shift in your consciousness. The things that, it's just like, how did you know that you became from a child to an adult? Well, part of it was you saw physical changes in your physical body. But another part is that things which had interested you stopped interesting you. I remember taking out my dolls and there was just no enjoyment in them anymore. I tried playing with them and it was just boring. I didn't want to play with them anymore. Instead, I was interested in curling my hair. So it's natural that as you progress in bhakti, your interest will start to change. That's very natural. That should be happening. And as your interests change, then you understand it's time for me to take another step. It's time for me to do something different. Or the same thing happens, you know, biologically. When you get to about the middle of your life, you stop being so interested in careers and money and family anymore. Materialists call this the midlife crisis. And we say, oh, it's time for renunciation. So these things happen in a natural progression. That's the simplest answer. There's a much more complicated answer. The simplest answers. And Srila Prabhupada talks a lot in this verse about taking shelter of the internal energy. That the way that we become free from all this too much, too much, too much, too much, which we're really overloaded with this message in modern society. It's being thrown at us from all sides. Have too much. Have more than you need. Have a house that's bigger than you need. Have more gadgets than you need. Have more clothes than you need. Have bigger cars than you need, right? This is just being screamed at us. Spend more money than you need. Buy more clothes than you need. Buy more shoes than you need. Get all kinds of things you don't need. And get the wrong kind of stuff. Have the wrong kind of entertainment, the wrong kind of clothes, the wrong kind of everything. The wrong kind of friends. So how do we get out of this? And Prabhupada says, by taking shelter of the internal energy. By really having our heart in line with this idea of service. And so then we can look at everything that we have and everything that we do. And is this really service to Krishna? Is this, again, with the idea of benefit? Is this something that's really benefiting me? Do I really need this for my service? That doesn't mean that we have to have a home with only, you know, two sets of clothes. And, you know, the home is just as big as a closet because that's all we need to turn around in, like some little cage for an animal. I'm not saying that at all. But we should really think, what do I need for my service? And part of what I need for my service is, what do I need for my own peace of mind? You know, maybe I only want to do laundry once a week, etc., etc. So that's also part of our service. What do I need for my own stability? We're talking about saving ourselves first. All right. Then on to the third verse is, okay, those are the things to get rid of. Now, what are the things that we're going to actually do? What are the things I want to take on? Because we're really talking here, again, not being empty, but being full with Krishna, being full with the positive. So here we have the list of what we're going to take on. Well, we're going to be enthusiastic. A lot of times people associate enthusiasm with passion. The enthusiasm of passion is an enthusiasm for a result. I think I'm the doer and I'm working for a result. And if I think the result is achievable, then I'm enthusiastic. And as soon as I think the result is not achievable, I don't become enthusiastic. My enthusiasm goes up and down with how clearly and how easily I think the result can be obtained. So that's not what we mean here by enthusiasm. We mean, how does Srila Prabhupada put it? I have it here. He says it's endeavor executed with intelligence in Krishna consciousness. So in Krishna consciousness means with consciousness of Krishna. So I'm doing things while being aware of Krishna. That's what it means to be enthusiastic. I'm aware of Krishna and I'm doing things with intelligence, with that awareness. Which means that I'm acting very much in the present moment. I'm not really future oriented for some fruit. But I'm acting to please Krishna now. And if you're acting to please Krishna now, one can be enthusiastic all the time. Because your fruit is right now. Your fruit is not future. Just imagine how enthusiastic you'd be if you were getting your results constantly. Then your enthusiasm would never wane. Whereas if you're working for a future fruit, then our enthusiasm is going to be how much do we believe we can achieve it. But here, if we are in the process of achieving it at every moment, one can always be enthusiastic. So this is doing some endeavor with consciousness of Krishna, with intelligence. Intelligence here does not mean having a high IQ. It doesn't mean knowing your Pythagorean theorem. It means spiritual intelligence. It means what Krishna calls buddhi yoga, understanding what's right and what's wrong, what pleases Krishna, what doesn't please Krishna. All right, and then we have endeavoring with confidence. So confidence is that I'm confident that the process I'm confident that what I'm doing is pleasing to Krishna, that Krishna says it's pleasing to him, and I believe it. And we get this confidence certainly from hearing from the scriptures and from hearing from guru and hearing from saintly persons, but also by direct experience. We get that kind of confidence that I can feel that I'm happy, I can feel that I'm peaceful, I can feel that I'm getting freedom. And that way I have confidence that I'm doing the right thing. Exactly like when you're driving, there are signs that let you know that you're driving the right way. There are signs, there's landmarks. You know, you're walking, and then you're walking back, and, oh, I saw that place when I was walking. And I have confidence that I'm walking the right way because I remember that shop. I remember we passed that shop, or I remember we passed that tree. So I know I'm on the right road. So this confidence comes from these kind of landmarks that we're seeing, that the scripture is telling us at this stage this is going to happen, at this stage this is going to happen, and we practically see that. And then patience. Then patience. Of course, if you're only enthusiastic, you're probably passionate, and if you're only patient, you're probably ignorant. So both enthusiasm and patience. That I'm expecting that things take time. I went to see a chiropractor this morning, and there was a sign up that said, healing takes time. You know, you don't expect to go to a doctor and find that you're instantly healed. I mean, everybody would love that, right? Some kind of science fiction movie. You just stick you in a machine, and you press a button, zoop! But healing takes time. Even fast healing takes time. It's not instant. There's no cream you can put on a cut and you just look at it and it closes right before your eyes. You know what I mean? There's some time involved. And probably gives the example in this purport, which probably doesn't make sense to most modern women, but he gives the example in the purport of the newly married girl who says, "Where's my baby?" as soon as she gets married. Again, I think most modern women wouldn't relate to this at all. But he says that. He said, of course, as soon as you're married, you can try to have a child, but it's not going to happen instantaneously. Even if you get pregnant on your wedding night, it's still going to take 9 months before you have that baby in your arms. So there's patience. Things have to develop in the proper time. Now, that doesn't mean that it should be just dry and empty and you're not getting any symptoms of advancement. There should be symptoms of advancement coming. You know, again, it's like a journey. It's not that you're just driving without any sign that you're on the right road and you're just patient that you're going to get there. But there should always be signs that you're making progress and always be some kind of direct experience. At the same time, one is patient. And this is, oh my dear, patience with others and patience with ourselves. I got this long email from a devotee, a rather sad email, about some of his disappointing dealings with other devotees. How he had interaction with other devotees that really disappointed him. These other devotees didn't act properly. I spent about 2 weeks thinking about how to answer him because it was quite a sad letter. And I wrote back basically saying, we also have to be patient with ourselves. And we tend to think, I have all good qualities and everybody enjoys dealing with me, but I have to suffer dealing with others. But the reality is that people suffer dealing with us too. We all know in our heart of hearts that we don't always live up to our ideals, yes? Anybody here say, anybody ready to say, I live up to all my ideals perfectly every minute of the day? Anybody? No, we disappoint ourselves regularly. At least I disappoint myself at least once a day, if not several times a day, sometimes really badly. Sometimes I really disappoint myself. I mean, sometimes I'm just like, oh, why did I do that? Why did I say that? I can't believe that I did that. So this is also patience with our faults, patience with our attachment, and patience with the faults and attachments of others. And what I pointed out to this devotee, I said, just like Krishna is helping you and teaching you and purifying you, so he's helping and teaching and purifying everybody else. So, definitely patience. Not becoming completely discouraged. I mean, one devotee was talking to me this morning, oh, you know, I can't think of Krishna 24 hours a day and I feel so discouraged. I said, well, celebrate the times when you do think about Krishna. And be patient. As long as you're making progress, you can be patient. Just see that we're making progress. Okay. And then we have acting according to the regulative principles. So not making up our own process. Following the process that Krishna has given. And we're going to skip one for a minute. Following the footsteps of the previous acharyas. So following the process as other sadhus and acharyas in the past and present have shown us how to do it. So you're not just following the scripture. The scripture is saying, okay, hear about Krishna, chant about Krishna, remember. Well, how do I do that? You know, okay, I've got this in the scripture, but where's the model? So then we look at the devotees for our model. So I don't make up my own process. Sometimes people make up their own process. I mean, I know one sannyasi that made up a process of chanting the Panchatattva mantra on his beads instead of the Hare Krishna mantra. And started his own movement of just chanting the Panchatattva mantra. So, you know, don't make up your own process, even if you think it's a great process. We're trying to please a person. Krishna is a person. We're trying to make him happy. If I want to make you happy, then the best way to make you happy is to ask you how to make you happy. I was so thrilled when one devotee asked me, wrote to me before I came here, Urmila, I'd like to do something for you. What would you like? I was like, oh, finally, somebody asked me what I would like instead of just doing something for me, hoping that maybe I would like it. So if we want to please Krishna, we have to please Krishna. Ask Krishna what is he likes, and that he gives in the scriptures. And if we want to have a model, we need a model. And then we follow the way others have done it. How do the sadhus do it? And what I find fascinating about this verse is although this verse is about the positive things, there's a negative one in here. And the negative one in here is giving up the association of the non-devotees, which was mentioned also in the previous verse. So it's interesting that this is it's mentioned in the negative, even in the positive. And this is one of the most important principles of advancing spiritually, is giving up our intimate relationship with people who are going to push us into materialism. And I think it's one of the big challenges when people start spiritual life, is having to change some of their friends and some of their associates. Of course, some of them reject you for you. You don't have to reject them. They'll reject you. As soon as you don't go to the pub anymore, whatever it was you were doing before, you know, or as soon as you just start talking about God, or, you know, some of them will very conveniently reject you, and you don't have to worry about rejecting them. Okay, so these first three verses are about how we control our senses and mind, anger, tongue, belly, genitals, etc., by engaging them in Krishna's service. Then how we give up the things that are hindering our bhakti, which is mostly too much, too much, too much, too much, too much. The only thing you can't have too much of is love of God. But you can even have too many rules, or the wrong kind of rules, or the wrong kinds of things. Too much things and the wrong kind of things. And then our positive, being enthusiastic, being confident, being patient, following the process that Krishna is giving us, not trying to please Krishna with our concocted process, following that process according to the examples of the acharyas, and keeping company with the devotees. Having our intimate friendship with people who are also on the spiritual path, rather than having intimate friendship with materialistic people. So, any questions or comments? We can just take briefly a couple minutes here. Okay, thank you all for coming. Tomorrow we'll be doing 4, 5, and 6. And verse 4 is one of the most important verses that we have in Srila Prabhupada's books. He talks about the 6 loving exchanges between the devotees. And Prabhupada has two amazing sentences in that purport, and I'm going to give you a homework, a home fun assignment, and see if you can find those sentences. And then in text 5, Prabhupada talks about, Rupa Goswami talks about with what people we should have those exchanges. Text 5 is really interesting, text 5 and text 6, about discrimination, not discrimination in terms of prejudice, but discrimination in terms of discernment, intelligent discernment. And text 5 tells us how we can discern what association we should have, and text 6 tells us what we should not use as that criteria. So we'll be looking at those tomorrow. It's very helpful if you can read over the verses and purports before the class. If you can't read the purports, please at least do read the verses and skim the purports. So if you would take, please, at least 10 minutes before the class tomorrow to at least skim, at least read the verses thoroughly, and at least skim the purports. If you have the time to read the purports thoroughly, that would be very good. And what would be lovely is if you could come to the class prepared with some questions to ask. That would really appreciate it. And if it, you can come with very difficult questions. See if you can ask me a question that I can't answer. We should have some maha sweets or something for anybody who asks me a question I can't answer. We should arrange. All right? Okay, see you tomorrow, 7 o'clock. Oh, we're going to have class tomorrow and...